Zuma the seam. There goes Mike Weber. He will take it. Touchdown Buckeyes from 47. JT Barrett is in. Touchdown Ohio State. Throwback Buckeye football pounding away on Michigan State. Mike Weber's the man in there on first down, and he's got it with a gaping hole. And Mike Weber turns on the afterburners. He's going to take this one. Touchdown Ohio State. What a performance. Domination on the ground for the Buckeyes.
Running backs had their best game as a unit against a very good rush defense. They ran extremely hard and fast. J.K. Dobbins, obviously, and Mike Weber had his best day. It was good, very good game. Every year I've been involved in college football, there's like, what happened? Nature of the beast, zero conversation about what happened in the past and what could potentially happen in the future. We got to really have a good Tuesday practice. I'm going to be out of my damn mind about that. There's going to be zero conversation about that other than play really hard on Tuesday's practice and get ready for a game on Saturday.
Stafford, his pass is intercepted. It's Jamie Collins.
Kaiser on first and 10 goes to the sideline. This is caught. Kenny Britt has some open space, and he's into the end zone.
In case you're wondering, this is already the biggest lead that Cleveland has had this season.
One play call. This is Abdullah, and he's into the end zone for the touchdown.
Kaiser has time, steps up, and delivers. That's DeVal. Ball is loose. Lions have it. Lawson, the recovery. Wasn't touched. Lawson into the end zone. No flags.
Cleveland gets the extra down, and they were just trying to get that straightened out.
Second and goal. They're going to lunge for this here. Now they can't stop the clock.
Well, you got to get set. The Lions are trying to stay on him right now to make sure he can't get up. And I don't think they're going to be able to get this ball off. They're not going to be able to.
A quarterback sneak from, you know, over 2 yards out. I don't love that call.
Here's Crowell bouncing to the outside, and he's in for the end zone. And look at the Cleveland Browns throwing a punch right back. Kaiser's going to sneak it into the end zone. Touchdown, Cleveland.
Stafford on first and 10, going to air it out.
Over the shoulder, it's Galladay. Still going. And finally forced out of bounds after a brilliant over-the-shoulder catch. Second and 7. That pass is caught. Riddick into the end zone for the Lions touchdown.
Stafford puts some air under it. Has his man. It's Ebron. And he's in for the touchdown.
Stafford quick pass. First down. Tate Moore. Tate. 10. 5. Touchdown.
First and goal after the penalty from the 5. Kaiser going to fade pass. Back of the end zone. Slay. And it's intercepted.
I think our guys did a better job of executing, getting a man on a man and giving our backs a crease to run in. The defense overall, I think, was more execution than anything else. One of the things about this league, you just got to find a way to keep getting better. You know, it's continuous improvement is important. We're getting a little bit better in some areas and still got a lot of work to do, but that's one of them.
Couldn't finish it. On we go. We'll get ready for next week. Second half of the season, I thought our guys had a little more pep in their step. Fought hard, gave it everything they had. Obviously, that's a good football team over there. Made some plays. They have good players. And like I said, I think our guys are fighting. I mean, we're not by any stretch gonna lay down, but we're just gonna keep working at it, and we need to continue to get better. It's on me, so no need to go into it. I gotta do a better job with the offensive unit, just that simple. I'm taking a fall on everything. You know, we're an 0-9 football team right now, so it doesn't matter.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Yes, indeed. Welcome to the extravaganza. And on Monday, you might want to call today a Monday afternoon quarterback day, because we are going to be loaded up with football to discuss today. Thanks so much for joining us. I am Bob France. Cushlin is alongside. We've got a couple of great guests coming our way. We're going to talk about the game between the two teams that we cover the most because of their geographic location, if not for utter fandom. And I've said this many, many times, Cushlin, I am done being a fan of the Cleveland Browns. I can pretty much guarantee you that. They continue to not earn my attention. They do not earn my trust. They do not earn my respect. Quite frankly, they haven't earned and do not deserve my fandom. And thus it is over. But they played the Lions, a team that I certainly do support, if for no other reason than there are a lot of Lions fans listening right now who really want to believe in this team. And who knows? Maybe. Just maybe they have something to believe in right now. The Lions move back over 500, weathering the storm of a 4 losses in 5-game run. to win the last two against the Packers and Browns. It's a soft part of their schedule. The Packers only because Aaron Rodgers was not part of it. The Browns because they're the clowns. And next week it will be the Bears before the showdown against the division leader, the Minnesota Vikings. But yesterday, it was all about the Lions coming from behind, believe it or not. Although I have to say, you know, certainly there are going to be a lot of concerns that a lot of Lions fans have about that win yesterday. If you have to come from behind to beat the Cleveland Browns, something isn't going exactly the way it ought to be. I think that's fair to say. And if you can't stop the run for three solid quarters against a team like the Cleveland Browns, something isn't going the way it ought to be. I think that is fair to say. So we're going to cover both the Lions side and the Clowns side of this mess this afternoon. Coming up here in about, I don't know, a minute, 2 minutes, 5 minutes, very soon. We're going to be talking with Matt Urban, who covers the Lions for LionsWire.com. That's with USA Today. We'll get his thoughts on Matthew Stafford's comeback. He looked like more like the Matthew Stafford that everybody has come to know and love up in the D. In the second half, much more than he did in the first half, very, very pedestrian showing in the first half. And speaking of the run defense for Detroit was completely lacking in the first three quarters. They could not stop the Browns on the ground. And it was only when the Browns abandoned that running game that the Lions were able to force a bunch of three and outs and take over the game. But it's a win, and that's the most important thing from the Lions side. And then coming up at about 4:10 today, we're going to talk to Scott Petrak, who is on the Browns beat and is unfortunately scrambling like everybody else out there in Cleveland to figure out how it is that Hugh Jackson wasn't fired at halftime for that inexplicable blunder in which you have a second and goal from the three. Now, mind you, that's the three-yard line, not the three-inch line. Quarterback sneaks from a foot, maybe. But even then, with no timeouts left to call a quarterback sneak, in which you are guaranteed for a massive pileup that will take a little while to unpile, especially when the Lions are laying there delaying the game and not getting on the other side, just to call that play with no timeouts left and 15 seconds on the clock to call a sneak is simply inexcusable. Hugh Jackson should have been fired at halftime for that mess. So we'll talk about all of that as we continue. And then, of course, wild, wild elimination Saturday in college football. The college football playoff committee is going to have some adjusting to do. A whole bunch of teams pretty much lost their shot at making the playoffs. Some other teams may have been thrust back into the realm of the possible when that new ranking comes out tomorrow night. But for now, let's stay on the Browns and the Lions, or better said, the Lions and the Browns. And joining us, as mentioned, is Matt Urban. He covers the Lions for the USA Today Lions site, which is Lions Wire, formerly of SideLions.com. But either way, he's all over Detroit. And Matt, thanks for joining us here in Toledo. We appreciate it. How are you?
Great, man. Thanks for having me on.
All right, it's good to have you on.
Lions, huh?
What's that?
It's good to talk a little Lions Browns.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's good to talk Lions. It's never really good to talk Browns. I mean,
it just
becomes such an embarrassment, which we'll detail in a bit. But let's, you know, as embarrassing as they are, I suppose let's do this. Let's talk about some of the concerns for the Lions, even in victory, because this Browns team is so bad. They are so, you know, such a joke. For the
right.
Lions to have such a hard time stopping them, their defensive front was literally getting blown up. For virtually three quarters, the Browns were able to run the ball, especially in the second half. They came out and had two long 80-plus yard drives in which they ran the ball six out of eight plays on the first one, seven out of ten on the second one, and the Lions were powerless to stop the run.
Right, I agree.
How concerned are you about that?
I mean, I am concerned because I think all season the Lions have kind of covered up their inefficiencies with big plays. I mean, yesterday, I think opportunistic is the word that comes to mind. Like Nevin Lawson, their cornerback, he was playing terribly. A lot of guys were saying on Twitter he should have been benched, and then he comes out and makes that forced fumble for a touchdown, and just like that, you know, they're tied up. So, I mean, there's definitely some concerns there. Even over the deep middle of the field, I think Kaiser exposed. You know, they're not that good covering the tight end. And also with the running game, I mean, they couldn't do anything against the Browns for three quarters, I think it was. And yeah, somehow, you know, as they have all season, they've came up big in the fourth quarter and, you know, found a way to win games that, you know, they shouldn't have been that close in that game. The Browns, they played well, but, you know, I just, there's a lot to be concerned about as a Lions fan, even in a win.
Yeah, I completely agree. And you're right about DeShone Kizer. I think Hugh Jackson said after the game that it was his best game as a rookie. And that should say something about your ability to cover, as you say, in the deep middle, against tight ends. And really just in general, not getting enough pressure on him, or even sometimes when they did, they allowed him to scramble and get out of the pocket and make some things happen with his legs. So overall, you know, defensively, is this team progressing or are they regressing based on how they started the season?
That's what to say. I mean, you know, when you're without Ziggy Ansah, that's going to be a big loss for you. But even so, I mean, other than that, they were pretty healthy. And, you know, they got Glover Quinn back. But it's a little concerning to see them so weak in the secondary. And then the run defense, even though A'shaun Robinson, I think, has been playing pretty well, second-year defensive tackle out of Alabama, I think just something that isn't there. And they do seem to just, you know, play when they want to play. It doesn't seem like... I've seen them play really well, good run defense this season, and then, you know, like yesterday, you see the Browns run all over them, and it's just really just scratching your head, really. I don't really understand how to explain it, so.
Matt Urban is our guest. He covers the Lions for LionsWire.com, LionsWire.USAToday.com. You put a piece together today for the website. Four takeaways from this game, and one of them is Eric Ebron. We got to talk about that, the fact that he's selected as a captain. You know, on the Browns radio broadcast, they mentioned that if Eric Ebron sneezes, he gets booed in Ford Field. I mean, he is not a popular guy there, and you know, and there's a little history there. So, what do you make of the fact that they made him a captain and he responded with a touchdown?
I mean, I think that's all you can expect out of Ebron. You know, we know what he is at this point. He's not a bust. You know, Greg Robinson, our left tackle, they just cut. He's a bust.
Yep.
But, you know, Eric Ebron, he's not going to be Jimmy Graham. I think we know that now. But if he can just make the catches when they're there for him, like yesterday, you know, that catch was huge. I mean, that put the game away. But it really is true, though. Like, the Bluebirds come out for him. Even when he makes a catch, they cheer him louder than anybody, and then they boo him. If a tight end in general, I make this joke all the time, if a tight end for the Lions drops a pass, people just assume it's Ebron, and, you know, they lump him in with that. But, you know, like yesterday, he wasn't a huge part of the offense, but he came out and, you know, he did his job. That's all you can really ask of him, and that's what I wrote in the column yesterday. You know, you got to be happy with him. 39 yards, that's not much, but, you know, it was enough. So.
Yeah, and 2 out of 3 targets, you know. I mean, does that mean if it's 7 targets, he'll catch 6 of them? Not necessarily, but certainly baby steps, and this had to make him feel good, of course, to get a touchdown and actually hear some cheers from from the home fans.
Yeah, definitely.
Let's talk about I'm sorry, Matt. Let's talk about Kenny Golladay. You also made a note, obviously, of how important it is to get him back, and he certainly did make an impact.
Yeah, you know, he didn't have a great game yesterday, but that one catch he had, I think it was 50 yards.
Yeah.
He's their biggest receiver, and I don't count Ebron, really. He's in that tweener thing. But, yeah, you know, Marvin Jones, I think, is 6'1", 6'2". Golden Tate's like 5'11". They don't have that big red zone target. He didn't really get targeted yesterday in the red zone too much, but in general, that makes the Lions so much better to have just one physical receiver out there. We know how much Matthew Stafford loves those big receivers back when he had Calvin Johnson. And, you know, Galladay's got a long way to go, but he was a big part of their 2-0 start and really almost 3-0 start if you count the Atlanta loss. But, yeah, you know, he's been missing a couple of weeks and he got back out there. You know, he didn't set the world on fire, but 62 yards on a game where, you know, Golden Tate got a lot of catches and yards. That's impressive. And I think he's a big part of the Lions. Most of their wins this season, he's been a big part of them.
Matt, let's go back to the defensive side and that defensive line, because I made a note, obviously, that the defensive line, really the front seven, got blown off the ball a lot as far as the Browns running game. But you did point out they got some pass rush, especially getting a sack from Anthony Zettel.
Yeah, I think he's been kind of a lone bright spot on that defensive line this season. He's been consistent. I think he's got 6 sacks in 6 different games. You know, you got to be happy with a 6th-round pick in his second year coming and contributing to that level, because, you know, they lost Terry Hyder in the preseason. That was a big loss. People wondered where that production was going to come from. And you've been really without Ziggy even in the past 2 years. I mean, this season he's been healthy, but he's been in and out. He's been injured a lot. So they really haven't had that guy off the edge to really count on. And I think, you know, Zettel's not there yet, but he's getting there. And to see that kind of production and that leap from year 1 to 2, I think, is really encouraging for the Lions. He's leading the team in sacks, I think. The 6, so yeah, I like what I see out of
Zettel
for sure.
Overall, we're talking to Matt Urban from LionsWire.com, LionsWire.USAToday.com. Overall, how long can they get away with what they've been getting away with in a lot of their victories, and that is falling behind early and then just counting on Stafford to make enough big plays in the second half and really usually in the fourth quarter to come back on teams and put teams away? you know, you can do that for a little while, I suppose. When you start to get into the second half, which we are now, and certainly down toward the playoffs, that's the kind of thing that gets a lot harder and harder to do as the weeks go by.
Right.
Are they capable of getting a lead and playing with a lead, or is just this just their MO? Is this just how they're made up that they, you know, they're going to fall behind and have to scramble?
I think they're going to keep doing it. I mean, like, you see against any legit team, they haven't been able to come out and play four quarters. I mean, Carolina, I mean, even in New Orleans, they came back and had a shot against New Orleans somehow, but, you know, you can't live like that. And, yeah, I don't think against a good team we're going to be able to win a lot of games like that. I mean, it's going to work against the Browns, against, you know, the Packers without Aaron Rodgers, but, you know, when you play against the Saints or whoever in the playoffs, I don't think you can do that. And, you know, Stafford has never really been a first-half quarterback. He's always kind of lit it up in the second and fourth quarter. But, you know, I agree with you. I think it's a concern, and it's one of the reasons I don't think they're really a contender at this point. If they can go out and string four or five wins together, even though their schedule is pretty easy down the stretch, you know, then maybe I'll change my mind, but you want to see them come out and play like they did against the Packers. But like I said, that doesn't really count because, you know, they were playing Brett Hundley and they're clearly, they might be done for the season. So, against a good team, I don't think they can do it, but yeah, go ahead.
Do you think that that is one of the things that keeps Matthew Stafford out of that, that mythical upper echelon, that top tier pantheon? You know, a lot of people like to break quarterbacks down into top tier, second tier, third tier, bottom tier. And
right.
most of the time in his career, putting up big numbers has had him in that second tier, but, you know, not having a playoff win. And I'm wondering if the fact that, as you say, he's only been half a quarterback, meaning second half quarterback, as opposed to not dominating and playing to the best of his ability for all four quarters, is that holding him back from reaching that next level?
Well, you know, it's like his greatest strength and weakness. You know, his greatest strength is that no matter what the situation is, second half, he's going to put you back in the game, give you a chance to win, but I think you see Peyton Manning and those guys in that top tier like Brady, you know, they can come out and do it in the first quarter and, you know, they're not gonna, it's not anything new for them. Stafford, it does seem like he'll always end up by the third or fourth quarter, you end up saying, all right, well, there he is. But yeah, it's just something with him. He's never been like a quick starter, I guess. And I think that's something that elite quarterbacks do. And he's on that precipice of being elite. You know, he's getting there. And this season, his overall numbers are pretty solid. I think he's got 17 touchdowns, to five picks or something like that. But, yeah, like you said, I mean, he never looks, like even in the Arizona game, after getting that huge contract, you know, he comes out, there was a pick on the first drive, and, you know, first half of that game, fans were kind of wondering, oh, great, do we just give this guy, you know, $100-something million to be an average quarterback? But he responded well in that game, and he did, came back out, led them to a late win, and that's what he did yesterday, but I just don't know if that's ever going to be something that can win in the playoffs. Maybe if the Lions get a better defense, you know, he won't have to play like that, but I do think it's on him a little bit. I agree with you.
We're talking to Matt Urban, who covers the Lions for Sideline. Or I keep going back to your old one. Sorry about that. Lions
no
Wire
problem,
at USAtoday.com. Yeah. Matt, our man Jim Cushlin here alongside me, has got a question for you. Jimmy, go ahead.
You know, I couldn't help but notice, Matt, a few minutes ago during one of the questions, you said you don't really think the Lions are that much of a contender. And I could kind of see some of the arguments out there as to why not. However, the schedule, as you pointed out, is an easier one down the stretch. Despite the struggles, they still got a win against the Browns. And as long as you're at least still putting up the W against the Browns, it can't be all bad.
Yeah.
Now you get a Bears team in Chicago on Sunday. They're struggling, but though not as much as Cleveland, all this leading up to arguably the toughest game left on their schedule, this Minnesota game on Thanksgiving Day. And my question here is, even if you don't think they're still a contender, because they do, of course, and this is not just this year, but going back, have issues against the more winning playoff type teams, but aren't they now, with that W behind them and going forward at least these next weeks, aren't they at least set up to make the noise if they can go out and get the wins?
Absolutely. I mean, I 100% agree with you. I think they have a chance to make, you know, I think they got a pretty good shot to win the division, to be honest. I just think, you know, I won't know who they are. You know, they can probably scratch out this win against the Bears and whoever, but, you know, they got to really dominate that Vikings team for me to see that they are a contender. I think they can make a playoffs this year, almost even if they don't win the division. I think 9 wins will probably get them in this year, but, because the NFC is, you know, it's full parity this year, but, you know, they just haven't ever really done it against the bigger teams. And until they win a playoff game, it's hard to say they are a contender. I mean, I like their chances to get in there and I think I got a real good shot in the first round, but I mean, I'm just wary of saying it before I see it happen, you know?
Matt, I'm interested in your take on the NFC as a whole, because it is a mess of a, you know, standings right now, if you will. I mean, you know, and obviously there's still a lot of time. We just really started the second half of the year. But looking at the contenders, there are a lot of them. There are a lot of teams that could really get into the playoffs and make a lot of noise. When you say they're not necessarily, you know, real contenders at this particular point in time, are we talking about for making the playoffs or for getting in there and winning anything?
That's what I mean, getting in there and winning anything. I think they can. I think they're definitely a contender to get into playoffs. But to actually go do something, like you said, I'm not so sure yet. And we'll see how they play. But, yeah, like the NFC is just full of teams. I mean, the Saints, they were so dominant yesterday. The Cowboys, everybody would start, were ready to anoint them, and then the Falcons go down there and just shut them. Or they actually played on the road there. But, yeah, the Falcons just made them look silly yesterday. And it's hard to say who's good outside of the Eagles, and even they. Can you trust them yet? They got a young quarterback. They've never done anything in the playoffs. So it's tough to read the NFC right now, definitely.
Yeah, it really is interesting. I mean, you know, the Eagles look like the best team in the conference, but the Rams are coming hard. And obviously, you know, in the division, it's Minnesota that you have to look at. You trail by two games. Talking about the Lions trail by two games. And you got that showdown in a week. Any chance that, Jim Caldwell does not have them laser-like focused on the Bears? And, you know, it's the proverbial trap game. The Bears are a bad
team.
Oh,
absolutely.
You know, I mean, that's a concern, at least to me it is.
Definitely. I see that, too. I mean, last year I wrote, before they play the Bears the first time, Bears could be a trap game, and they ended up losing that game. I feel the same way this year. I mean, Bears, they've been competitive all year. They have a really tough defense, and that's the kind of thing that gives Detroit trouble. They probably won't be able to run the ball against them very well, and, you know, it's probably going to be a similar game to this week. I mean, they'll probably be losing or playing tough and then pull away at the end or hopefully not lose that game, because that would be just devastating for their season if they lost that before heading into that Thanksgiving matchup against the Vikings. Yeah, I mean, that's definitely a dangerous game. I don't think Caldwell will – I think he will have them ready to play, but if they do or not, that's a different story, you know.
What do you think Minnesota does with Teddy Bridgewater now that he's been activated? Case Keenum responded to Teddy Bridgewater's activation by going 21 of 29 for 304 and four touchdowns. He did throw two picks, which hurt his rating, but it was even with the two picks, 117. He had his best game right after Teddy. You know, it's almost like he's just saying, Coach, don't mess with what isn't broken. You're doing just fine over here.
And I don't think they should. I mean, I've been completely flabbergasted to see him play so good. I mean, you know, he's a guy that's been around the league. He's well bounced around. But it seems like now that they are, like you said, now that they're saying, you know, Bridgewater's activated, he's our guy, he's a former first-round pick. Obviously, fans are going to want him to get in there, but I don't see how you bench a guy like that coming off four touchdowns in a game that, who did they play yesterday?
Washington.
Washington, yeah. So, I mean, Washington, they beat the Seahawks 2 weeks ago, so it's not like that was a – that's something to sniff at. That's a pretty impressive victory with Keenum out there.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, I don't know. I would stick with Keenum if it was me. I know Bridgewater is a talented kid. He hasn't played in almost 2 years. I wouldn't put him out there with the season going like it is.
No, I can't imagine them benching Keenum and making a change now, considering how well he's playing. But, you know, it's this league. And as you said, with the fans making the noise, if Keenum goes out there and has a bad half, or if he goes out there next week and has a bad game, throws three picks and one touchdown and, you know, completes 55% of it. You know what I'm saying? If he stumbles at all, you just wonder how quick someone is going to be to say, all right, Teddy, the job is yours. You shouldn't lose your job on an injury anyway. Come on back.
Right.
You just wonder if they're going to ride the guy who's essentially led them since Bradford went down. They're 7-2. They have the second best record in the NFC.
Right, and I agree. I mean, if you and me were making that call, I'm pretty sure we would roll with Keenum. But I know that Zimmer really likes Bridgewater, and when he went down with that non-contact injury in practice a couple years ago, I thought the team was just devastated. They really liked the kid. I mean, he's a first-round pick, so I do think, you know, if he struggles at all, they're going to want him out there just to see what he's got.
Yeah,
but
I really
I don't
like
think
the
that's
kid
right
too,
call.
By the way. I really like Teddy Bridgewater, too. I want to see him come back and have a great career. But for now,
absolutely.
My goodness, Case Keenum has got those guys rolling in. We'll see if they're still rolling when they play the Lions in 2 weeks. Matt Urban, tremendous job. Thanks so much. Keep up the great work. You want to check him out on the webpage, lionswire.usatoday.com, lionswire.usatoday.com. Matt, thanks for spending the time with us here in Toledo talking Lions.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it. Anytime.
You got it. We'll reach back out to you again soon. There you go. Okay. That's Matt Urban talking a little Lions with us. We're going to kind of cover yesterday's Lions-Browns game from all angles, including the Browns side, coming up at about 4:10. Our man Scott Petrak, who covers the Browns out there in Cleveland, will join us to talk about why Hugh Jackson is still coaching this team instead of being fired at halftime, which he should have been. I know that's never happened before, but it's something that should have happened yesterday, and we'll explain why when we get to talking to Scott in just a little bit. But for now, let's talk a little bit more about the Browns in our Wild Stat of the Day.
ESPN 106.5 The Ticket presents The Wild Stat of the Day, brought to you by Buffalo Wild Wings, Wings, Beer, Sports.
The Browns lost to the Lions yesterday, now have them with a new NFL record. It's their 26th consecutive loss on a Sunday. That beats the 25 straight Sunday losses, first set by the expansion Buccaneers in 1976 and 77. Which lost their first 26 overall. The last Browns win on a Sunday was Week 14. That was back in on December 13th of 2015 in a 24-10 win against the San Francisco 49ers. So the beatings go on for the Cleveland Clowns. We're going to talk more about that as we continue our Monday afternoon quarterbacking. Also want to remind you that we are going to discuss, as a matter of fact, after the bottom of the hour sports that is coming up, bottom of the hour local sports center, I should say, we're going to be discussing college football. The Buckeyes rebound in a huge way. Notre Dame proves to be the fraud. I told you not to trust Brian Kelly in this game. You saw what happened. We'll break down what most people were calling Elimination Saturday from this past Saturday in college football. Who was eliminated? Who's still alive? We'll get into that coming up next. If you want to be a part of the conversation, it's 866-240-1065. Irish fan, where are you? I would like to hear your thoughts after the Coral Gables beatdown right here on the Ticket.
Extravaganza right now by calling 866-240-1065. Now back to the Bob France Extravaganza on 106.5 The Ticket.
Indeed, rolling right along, we are at 3:42. Thanks so much for being with us right here on the Extravaganza. We're going to talk more NFL football coming up at about 4:10 with Scott Petrak. Talk about the Browns beatdown, their ninth consecutive loss this season. Kush, they are now the third team, and I can't remember the other one. I had it yesterday. The third team in NFL history to start two consecutive seasons, 0-9. The other one is that Buccaneers team we had in the Wild Stat, 1976-77. Mm-hmm. And there was one other team, and I can't remember what it was, and it's okay, it doesn't matter. But the fact is,
I was going to look this up and try to find it just out of sheer morbid curiosity.
Yeah, you can if you want to, but I mean, the point here is obvious. I mean, how many NFL seasons have there been? When was the first NFL season? Second of all, how many different teams have there been in each of those seasons? Think about how rare that is. For one team to have back-to-back seasons, 0-9, if only three teams out of all the teams in all of the seasons throughout NFL history, for it to only happen three times, it is a new low. It is a new record of ineptitude and pointlessness. And that's exactly what they continue to do. They churn out more messes every single day. We're going to talk to Scott Petrak, or every week anyway. Scott Petrak of the Browns beat, about that coming up in just a bit. But for now, I want to dive into Elimination Saturday a little bit and try to kind of make a little bit of sense, if we can, of what we saw. We have to start, of course, with the Notre Dame-Miami game. I would like to start with Ohio State and give them credit, but you know what? Their 48-3 win over 12th-ranked Michigan State came a week late. Sorry, it is what it is. It came a week late. When you get blown out the way you did at Iowa, your incredible comeback the next week against Michigan State, to me, still kind of lacks a little bit of steam. It's unfortunate to me, very unfortunate to me, that things are kind of shaking out the way they are. Because somebody is going to be rewarded for all of those top-ranked teams battling one another and knocking one another off, thus eliminating one another on Elimination Saturday. Somebody is going to be the beneficiary of that when they do not deserve to be. Now, I want to say this to all of my Ohio State fans, all of the Ohio State fans listening and Buckeye diehards. I brought this up to somebody yesterday on Facebook. Somebody actually messaged and said Ohio State will make the playoffs if, and he laid out two or three things that he said simply, you know, are very, very likely to happen. And my response was, and I'm talking to my Ohio State fans as an Ohio State guy. I love the Big Ten. I love Ohio State. I do not hate Michigan at all. In fact, I like Michigan. I know that's not possible, but I'm just not that guy. I'm not that guy who's going to absolutely despise the other side in a rivalry, especially if I'm a fan of the conference. And being here in Toledo, obviously being, you know, equidistant essentially between Columbus and Ann Arbor, you understand the point. But I'm going to say what I said on Facebook yesterday. The Ohio State Buckeyes, if they went out and make the playoff, are going to make the playoff as one of the, not one of, probably the most undeserving teams to make the playoff since the playoff format began. Now, that might not be saying too terribly much, right? Because the playoff only began 4 years, this is the fourth year for it. But they have yet to have a two-loss team in the playoffs. But because of Notre Dame getting beaten down, because of Georgia being taken down, because of other teams losing high-profile showdown matchups, the chances are good that a two-loss team is going to make the playoffs for the very first time. And I would submit to you, despite our Ohio location and loyalties, that this Ohio State team should not be the first two-loss team to make the college football playoff. I'm just looking at what Ohio State has done well this season in terms of its record and in terms of its quality wins and that sort of thing. And I have to tell you, that 48-3 win over what I think is maybe a little bit overrated Michigan State, I think we could all agree that Michigan State is better than people thought they would be, but they're not a national power. Their 13th ranking was a little bit, maybe, or 12th ranking, I beg your pardon. It was 12 versus 13 this past weekend at Columbus. Might have been just a little bit higher than what it should have been, even after beating Penn State. Penn State, of course, lost two in a row after Ohio State took them apart in that incredible comeback. So that 48-3 win at home over Michigan State, in my opinion, does not undo the damage of a 55-24 loss on the road to Iowa the week before. You lost literally. I mean, that cannot happen. You simply cannot lose by 31 points on the road at Iowa and then say, well, but we won by 45 points at home against Michigan State, and say, okay, that balances the scale. It does not balance the scale. And even if it does, you cannot overlook, I can't anyway, even though it was way back in September, Saturday, September 9th, week two of the college football season, 31-16, a 15-point loss at home to Oklahoma. At home. Now, you might say to yourself, well, look at Oklahoma now. Oklahoma's number 3 in the AP. And number 5 in the coaches' poll. They're a damn good team. Well, yeah, they're a damn good team. Everybody already knew that. Baker Mayfield is one of the most prolific players in college football. He's doing tremendous things on a weekly basis. What he and his Sooner offense was able to do on Saturday against TCU, one of the country's best defenses, was just spectacular. I'm not suggesting that it was, you know, to a scrub, but they didn't lose at home by two to that great offense. They didn't lose at home in a field goal game. They got blown out. They got dominated by Oklahoma. Then they got dominated by Iowa. And to be quite frank, in between those two games, the only game that was worth, you know, discussing in terms of feather in the cap is the Penn State win, and the Penn State win took a monumental fourth quarter comeback to make it happen. Had to come back down from 15 down in the fourth quarter to win. You don't undo, you know, the Oklahoma loss and the Iowa loss with a one-point comeback win over Penn State at home and then a blowout win over Michigan State at home, sandwiched, you know, around, not around, but those games followed the blowout wins over the likes of Army, UNLV, Rutgers, Maryland, and Nebraska. I'm just telling you this. Illinois isn't going to help the cause when Ohio State romps on Illinois this week. That isn't going to help the cause. The Michigan win, I'm saying this, don't get mad at me, Michigan fans. The Michigan win, meaning if they are to run the table, this was my premise at the start of this conversation, they would have to beat Michigan. So the Michigan win in such a scenario would give them a little bit more cred. Michigan is slowly climbing up in the rankings a little bit. They're up to 19th in the coaches poll this week, up two spots. And then you over, let's see, then you have, they are 18th in the ranking in the coaches poll. That is up four spots after the win over Maryland. They're running the ball very well. They're playing good defense. They still are trying to figure out the passing game now that they've given the ball to the redshirt freshman, Brandon Peters. Michigan will be a feather in the cap type of win for Ohio State because of the rivalry component of it and because of the high teens ranking of Michigan. But make no mistake, Michigan is not as good as Ohio State. That should be a win that should be relatively comfortable. If it is not, it will not be as much of a feather in the cap. And then, of course, they would have to beat what would be projected to be undefeated Wisconsin in the Big Ten championship game. That would be certainly big. So the question to be for the Buckeyes would be, does a blowout win over then 12th rated Michigan State, a comeback win over then second rated Penn State, a rivalry win over Michigan, and a Big Ten championship game win over Wisconsin undo the damage of a 15-point loss to Oklahoma in the horseshoe and a 31-point loss to unranked Iowa on the road? If you're asking me, and I don't have a vote in the college football playoff committee, but if you're asking me, I would have a hard time making that the first two-loss team to make it into the Final Four. Now, having said that, here's what we do know. Massive leap for the U. The U blowing out Notre Dame down in Coral Gables. Simply unexpected, to say the very least. I did not trust. Kush, what did I say on Friday's program when we previewed the Elimination Weekend? I said, do not trust Brian Kelly. He's done a better job than I would have expected earlier this year, you recall.
Uh-huh.
I called for Brian Kelly to be fired. I don't like him. I don't like his style, and I think he's an underachiever as a coach, to be honest. But they had been just, you know, really going gangbusters, if you will, for, you know, about 6 or 7 weeks in a row, and had the Irish, especially with some big wins over USC and another ranked team or two, had the Irish looking like, you know, the gold, the shine was back on the Golden Dome. But I said, I don't trust him in this big game on the road at Coral Gables to have his guys ready. And I can't say it any other way. Miami flat out dominated Notre Dame. I don't think Notre Dame is as bad as they looked. I don't think Miami is as good as they looked. I think Notre Dame was as unprepared as they looked, which is why I will put that primarily on Brian Kelly, whose quarterback, Brandon Winbush, looked anything but ready for that moment down there at the U. Notre Dame is now out. They are a two-loss team like Ohio State. They are a two-loss team like Auburn, teams that, you know, some people say might still have a shot at that Final Four, Kush, but I will tell you this, that loss wasn't just any old loss. It was a disqualifying loss. I'm shocked that Notre Dame, getting beaten 41-8, didn't drop out of the top 10.
Yeah.
They still hang there at number 9 in both polls. We'll see where they are in the playoff poll tomorrow, or playoff committee rankings. But in the AP and the coaches poll, I thought Notre Dame would fall out of the top 10. In much the same way that I thought Ohio State should have fallen way further down than they did after the 31-point loss at Iowa, when they didn't. They only dropped to 13th, and here they are, a blowout win over Michigan State. It has them back up to number 8 with a chance to climb higher into, as I just discussed, the college football Final Four. But Notre Dame, that was a disqualifying loss, and I don't know about you, but that was a – I didn't trust Brian Kelly, but I didn't think they would lose by, you know, 41-8.
That last part kind of sums up my feelings on Notre Dame and Miami. I kind of was thinking Miami, particularly because I had watched a full game of theirs just the week before because they smashed up my Hokies, which I'm now glad to say not as bad as they smashed up Notre Dame back on Saturday. But as such, I didn't expect a blowout of that proportions. And, you know, a lot of attention, especially around here, understandably on the Notre Dame side of things. The flip side of it is, and you're seeing this start to play, and you saw this starting to play out in the rankings where they had Miami ahead of Wisconsin, right, as two undefeateds, but, you know, 9th and 10th or whatever, or 7th and 8th in this case from this past week. Right. Yeah, this is going to keep Miami ahead of where Wisconsin is for those undefeated kind of things. And, Yeah, Miami definitely deserves to be in there. The way this is starting to shape up, Bob, one of the playoff spots is going to be the winner of a Miami-Clemson ACC title game.
No question.
The way it's going.
No question. If both of them win out until they play one another, you're absolutely right. That will be the winner of that game will be in the playoff, and I think very deservingly so. I mean, I'm not a big Miami fan, although they've been irrelevant in recent years, so I haven't been a hater either. I've just been, you know, they're just, you know, kind of indifferent to me. But I am extraordinarily impressed with what I saw and what they were able to do to Notre Dame. They looked faster. They looked stronger. They looked hungrier. They looked more inspired. Notre Dame looked, like I said, they looked like Brian Kelly, which is just, you know, yeah. I don't know.
I see just, what you're trying to say.
Yeah, it's hard to put into words, but it just, you know, it doesn't inspire me. They looked uninspired. Miami looked very inspired. And real quick before we take a quick phone call. Auburn, of course, is the other shocker. Auburn at number 10, we've talked about. What is the likelihood? Could Auburn beat Georgia and then Alabama? Already two losses, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Could Auburn, two-loss Auburn, beat Georgia and then Alabama and then beat probably Georgia again in the SEC championship game? Could they be a two-loss team that makes it into the Final Four? And would they be there with Alabama or without? Because will one loss Alabama drop out of the top four.
Yeah.
Auburn rolled college football playoff ranked number one Georgia 40-17. That to me was as big, if not a bigger shock than what Miami did to Notre Dame.
Yeah, exactly. And at bare minimum, because a lot of what you just stated there regarding Auburn is, plenty of things have to happen. I will say this. If it comes down to it, though, and Auburn is still at two losses when all this is done, yeah, they easily have the leg up on any other two-loss team in the nation, without question.
The question is if they beat Alabama, and that's Alabama's only loss.
Right, and that would have to be an SEC. No, that would be the Iron Bowl. Excuse me, sorry.
Say again?
That would be the Iron Bowl, excuse me.
Correct, right. That would be in the last regular season game of the season. Then it would be, you know, probably Georgia still going to win the SEC East. In fact, there's no probably about it. It will be Georgia. They'd have to play Georgia again.
Yeah, they've already clinched. Georgia has.
So Auburn against Georgia in the conference championship game, Alabama with one loss not playing in the conference championship
game. Because Auburn would have the tiebreaker, yep.
Would one loss Alabama be a better fit, meaning be more deserving of a spot in that Final Four, even if it's a second SEC team, than, for example, a two-loss Ohio State team that wins its conference championship game and has on that record, as I said, two very embarrassing blowout losses, one at home to Oklahoma and one on the road at Iowa.
Yeah, I would still lean Alabama as the number four in that scenario.
So they would lock out the Big Ten champion and give a second place, not even playing for the
As chaotic as this elimination weekend, as we've been calling it, Bob, was, that I do not think as of right now it changes the fact that the only way the Big Ten can get a team in the playoff is an undefeated Wisconsin. I still believe
Ohio State
could still believe that this weekend.
Okay, that's the question here. I mean, Clemson, Miami, they're going to decide something. They play one another at the end. Oklahoma is going to have to play. I don't know. How are they going to decide? It's just top two finishers,
top two
right?
finishers, yeah. So there is a rematch.
So they may have a rematch against TCU or Oklahoma State.
One of the two, depending on how the second place tiebreakers shake out.
And they've beaten them both. So,
correct.
You know, if you beat them again, that's something, too. The committee says, well, there's a one-loss, Big 12 championship team. How do we rank them? They beat the same team twice in order to win their conference championship. Of course, that's what Auburn would have to do to Georgia in the same scenario as well. They would have to beat the same team twice. How much stock will they put in that compared to somebody beating another highly ranked contender in their conference championship game, somebody they had not yet played? So that's another element to this as well. Let me get a couple of quick ones in here, Jim, and I know we have the top of the hour, but let me get Jimmy and Toledo on the air real quick. Jimmy, you're on the air. Go ahead, sir.
Yeah, you know, I'm a huge Ohio State fan, you know. Here's the thing, 31-0 to Clemson last year. The game obviously got out of hand. The defense played much better than that, but they were just overwhelmed because of the pathetic display of no offense. We used up our goodwill then. But first, the more than that, the 55 points to Iowa, there ought to be a rule from now on. If you ever give up 55 points to anyone, much less an offensively challenged Iowa that couldn't do squat against Wisconsin this weekend, you deserve to not be anywhere near the playoffs. I don't care who's on your team.
That's kind of what I'm saying, and I don't want my Ohio State friends and fans to get mad at me for this, but that's exactly what I'm saying. You don't deserve to be in the playoff if you have that kind of a loss.
More importantly, I don't want to squander any more good faith because we may just put it all back together next year, and if we go and we have a two-loss team get in this year, and we squander it again, and we can't cover a tight end, then what happens the next time we're on the bubble? We might actually have a good team like 2014, and we don't get in. Don't go and squander all of our good faith. Listen, we deserve to be shut out this year. We had our opportunity. We had a letdown, and it happened. Get Notre Dame in the Fiesta Bowl, or get an SEC team like an Auburn or a Georgia, somebody that makes it to the championship, or even Clemson if they lose to Miami, and go down there and beat the stuffing out of them and play your best. And then you got bragging rights. I would love to face Notre Dame and beat the stuffing out of them and then just rule, because we've lost a couple players to them recruiting-wise over the last couple years for the state of Ohio.
Yeah, that's very true.
So,
that's always an issue.
So, you know, hey, there's still some business to be handled.
No, yeah, you're right, and there's still some things to accomplish in the season, but the playoffs should not be one of them. And, Jimmy,
that's
I got to
run,
buddy. Thanks for the call. I thank you for the phone call. Let me get Rick in Toledo real quick before the top of the hour, and we shift gears into talking NFL again. Rick, go ahead, sir. You're on the air.
Hi. Actually, I just wanted to say that the last caller was completely what I was going to say. I agree with it 100%. But I just want to get your opinion. Do you think that the playoff rankings come out a little too soon? And people start thinking, now it's a ranking, and now you have to move up and move down. I think, in my opinion, they should maybe come out like before the championship game. That way, there's not a lot of explaining of why did this person jump so far up at the end of the year, whether it's going to be a two-loss Ohio State or possibly a two-loss Clemson or a two-loss Oklahoma that gets in. There's not as much controversy on why, since the rankings seem to come out a little too soon in the season.
Yeah, I do agree with you. They do come out too soon. We talk about that each year when they do come out, that the obvious reason they do this, and then they make it a primetime special half an hour event in which they show the, you know, the rankings. Here is where we are now. And by the way, tonight's rankings have absolutely no bearing on where we are next week. We're not moving somebody up or down from last week to this week. We are going to rank again from scratch. And if that's the case, then you know what? Then you just do it at the end. What's the point of doing this week by week thing, except for one thing, which you probably realize, money. They sell the hell out of that show. They put it on ESPN. They make a ton of money from the advertisers because everybody wants to know what the committee is thinking this week, and that's why they do it. But to answer your question directly, yes, they come out with it way too early. It's just simply a moneymaker, nothing more.
Right. Thank you very much.
All right, brother. Good call. I appreciate that. It's 4:03, a little bit late for our top of the hour Sports Center. Let's get there, then come back with Scott Petrak and talk more NFL right here on The Ticket.
Stafford. His pass is intercepted. It's Jamie Collins.
Kizer on first and 10 goes to the sidelines. This is caught. Kenny Britt has some open space, and he's into the end zone.
In case you're wondering, this already the biggest lead that Cleveland has had this season. One play called. This is Abdullah, and he's into the end zone for the touchdown.
Kizer has time, steps up, and delivers. That's DeVal. Ball is loose. Lions have it. Lawson, the recovery. Wasn't touched. Lawson into the end zone. No flags.
He gets the extra down, and they were just trying to get that straightened out.
Second and goal. They're going to lunge for this here. Now they can't stop the clock.
Well, you got to get set. The Lions are trying to stay on him right now to make sure he can't get up. And I don't think they're going to be able to get this ball off. They're not going to be able to.
A quarterback sneak from, you know, over 2 yards out. I don't love that call.
Here's Crowell bouncing to the outside, and he's in for the end zone. And look at the Cleveland Browns throwing a punch right back. Kaiser's going to sneak it into the end zone. Touchdown, Cleveland.
Stafford on first and 10, going to air it out.
Over the shoulder, it's Galladay. Still going. And finally forced out of bounds after a brilliant over-the-shoulder catch. Second and 7. That pass is caught. Riddick into the end zone for the Lions touchdown.
Stafford puts some air under and has his man.
It's Ebron, and he's in for the touchdown.
Stafford quick pass. First down, Tate Moore. Tate, 10, 5, touchdown.
First and goal after the penalty from the five. Kaiser little fade pass back of the end zone. Slay, and it's intercepted.
I think our guys did a better job of executing, getting a man on a man and giving our backs a crease to run in. The defense overall, I think, was more execution than anything else. One of the things about this league, you just got to find a way to keep getting better. You know, it's continuous improvement is important. We're getting a little bit better in some areas, and still got a lot of work to do, but that's one of them.
Couldn't finish it. On we go. We'll get ready for next week. Second half of the season, I thought our guys had a little more pep in their step. Fought hard, gave it everything they had. Obviously, that's a good football team over there. Made plays, and they have good players. And like I said, I think our guys are fighting. I mean, we're not by any stretch going to lay down, but we're just going to keep working at it, and we need to continue to get better. It's on me, so no need to go into it. I got to do a better job with the offensive unit, just that simple. I'm taking a fall on everything. You know, we're 0-9 football team right now, so it doesn't matter.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Indeed, rolling along we are. Hour number two underway at 14 minutes after 4 o'clock. Thanks so much for joining us. We broke a little late at the top of the hour, so we got a lot of catching up to do on Monday afternoon quarterback. And to do that, now we turn it over to our good friend Scott Petrak, who covers the Cleveland Browns. And I still think there should be hazard pay included for doing so. Out there on the Browns beat for low these many years, including these last two woe-begotten years. Scotty Petrak, thanks for the time, my friend. How are you?
I'm good, Bob. How are you?
I'm great, man. I'm better than you. I don't have to watch that team. I mean, honestly, I say this just for those who don't care, but Scott gives me nothing to promote BrownZone.com, nor would I take anything. I promote it because I thank you for it, because it's sites like yours, Scott, that I use to stop me from having to watch the Browns game. I literally do my level best not to watch the Browns play. They don't deserve my attention. They don't deserve my time. They don't deserve my rating that I might help add for them. So what I do, because I do this show for a living, is I rely on highlights and good, relevant articles with great deep insight and analysis like the ones that you write so that I can find out what happened in these games. So I really appreciate you doing that so I don't have to watch these clowns. You do. You've got to be there and interview them and talk to them and everything else. So it's with that backdrop that I'll ask you your overall impression. I'm going to ask you about halftime or the play before the half in a moment, but just your overall impression of a team that has now joined only two other teams in the great history of the National Football League to start 0-9 in back-to-back seasons, a team that is now 1-24 overall under the new front office's leadership and vision. Sashi Brown and Paul DePodesta under Jimmy Haslam's guidance and Hugh Jackson's coaching now 1-24. Just kind of lay it out what you observed yesterday.
Yeah, I mean, you can't escape the record, Bob, and you just laid it out, and it's awful, and they lost again yesterday, and it wasn't, you know, if you look at the final score, it wasn't even that close. They lost by, you know, 14 points and didn't even cover. However, you know, if you take a small view of just yesterday, there were signs of improvement. You know, I thought DeShone Kizer played his best game. I thought he was much improved coming out of the bye, and you know, it's in the backdrop of the Browns almost trading and trying to trade for A.J. McCarron, you know, during the bye week and take DeShone Kizer's starting job away. And I thought he played really well, and he showed toughness coming back from what are, you know, a painful rib injury. You saw the run game finally get on track. But the bottom line is they're a bad enough team that they make enough mistakes every week that even if they play, quote-unquote, well, it's not good enough. And they figure out a way to lose and usually lose by double digits. And we saw it again. And I think much of the blame yesterday falls on the defense, who was given a 7-point lead in the third quarter and then gave up 3 touchdowns to lose the game.
So much ground to till there. Let's talk about the DeShone Kizer factor first. You mentioned he had his best game. I would agree from what I've been able to deduce that it was. Hugh Jackson certainly said as much, and he said that he knew he had to do that. He didn't say, I have to play my best game, but he said, I have to step, which is the very correct answer, I think, for a young kid. I have to step my game up. What does the pursuit of A.J. McCarron tell me? It tells me that they're not 100% confident in what I can do, and I've got to step my game up to show that. He really did that, and I think that does say a lot about him, especially in adverse circumstances, on the road against a team that is in the thick of the NFC playoff chase.
Without a doubt, and it's loud in that dome. I mean, your listeners know it gets loud. And we're in a press box that's open air, so we can hear all the noise, and it's tough to hear. And, you know, he did a good job running the offense. you know, that's as good as the offense has looked. I thought it's as good a game plan and play calling job that Hugh Jackson's done this year, mixing the run and the pass. Hugh Jackson said today that, you know, we're going to talk later about the audible at the end of the half, but he said Deshaun Kizer did a great job audibling throughout the game. He audibled to the pass to Deshaun, or to Kenny Britt that turned into a touchdown. So you can see progress in, it's not just an isolated incident because I thought he played better against the Vikings, at least for a half plus, before the bye week. So I think there's growth being made with Deshaun Kizer. And the thing that I keep coming back to is he's different than previous Browns quarterbacks. I'm not saying he'll turn into a franchise quarterback. It's way too early to tell that.
Sure.
But he has traits and talent that make me think it can happen and make me think it's worth giving him the chance to see if he can develop into one.
I want to take a little bit of an issue with your praise for Hugh Jackson and his play calling, solely because of how it ended. They ran the hell out of the ball in the first half. They ran the ball very, very well. Again, just judging by all of the reading and the highlights that I have seen. And then they came out, and it's very easy to read this when it comes to the drives. In the second half, they came out after that debacle at the end of the first half, and they go 85 yards in eight plays. Six of the eight plays are running plays. I mean, Detroit's front seven is helpless. They cannot stop, you know, Isaiah Crowell or Duke Johnson or even Kizer running the ball a couple of times. Then they come back out the next drive, and they go 80, I think it was, in 10 plays.
Yeah.
Seven of those out of 10 were running plays. Now, that gives you the lead. And, yes, Detroit did come back and tie the game. But at that point in time, Hugh Jackson completely abandoned the run that had gotten him his lead. This team clearly runs the ball better than it passes the ball. They're running the ball really at will against this team, and then suddenly it's pass, 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 especially when Kizer went down and Kessler comes in and they start throwing it. And Hugh Jackson was asked after the game about it, and he said, well, we were trailing. I had to get some, you know, we had to throw to get back. They weren't. They right. weren't. They were winning at that time. Then Detroit tied it, and then they were down by seven. Why abandon the running game, which was your most effective and efficient way of getting points on the board in favor of a passing game that was not as effective? He just abandoned the run altogether, Scott. And that's one of the reasons why I think he needs to get out of the business of trying to be a head coach and an offensive coordinator at the same time. I don't think he can do both.
I think that's a fair question, and maybe even an overall fair point is that there's too much on his plate. I'm slowly coming over to that side. There's plenty of coaches that do both jobs and handle it fine. Obviously, we've seen him struggle with different parts of his job. But when it comes specifically to yesterday, I think his answer is bad when he says, or wrong, when he says, we were trailing, so I had to throw the ball. They were down by seven. There was 9 minutes left. You don't have to throw the ball.
Exactly.
When Cody Kessler's in the game. However, if you go back and look at it, I have one real quibble, and it's first down. They're kind of backed up. It's Kessler's first full series, and I think he threw it on first down, and then you feel like you need to keep throwing it. But on the second series with Kessler, they're down seven, so it's not the end of the world. He gets a 5-yard dump off to Duke Johnson, which is kind of an extended handoff. And then he's got Bryce Treggs running wide open for what would have been about an 80-yard touchdown, and Kessler just overthrows him by 10 yards.
Yeah.
So it's tough for me to blame a play call that could have, would have, should have been a touchdown if your quarterback just makes, you know, it was a deep throw, but there was nothing difficult about it, and he airmailed him by 10 yards. And then you have to throw because it's third down. So I get the overall point, but I think there's only one or two specific calls that I would quibble with Q and say he should have run the ball in those specific instances yesterday.
Yeah, I won't say in this specific play, this down and distance, you should have run the ball. I just mean he
right.
essentially abandoned the passing or the running game overall. I mean, he just did. You know, talk about the incomplete pass to Treggs. I mean, you're absolutely right if he makes that. But then, you know, you put yourself in a position where you hadn't been all day long. And that is the point where they know exactly what you're doing. They know you've abandoned the run. And then they start coming at you. And you remember the very next play was a sack after that incomplete pass. Go ahead.
I mean, I get what you're saying, Bob, but it's, I don't mean to cut you off. But Cody Kessler can't save himself from being sacked. And you saw night and day how Deshaun Kizer handles the pass rush and Cody Kessler can't. And maybe that's just more reason for you to hand the ball off when Kessler's in there.
Yeah.
But there are only six plays. There were six plays with Cody Kessler in there. and I think Hugh might have passed on five of them. So I get the
that
point.
That is exactly right. You had a Crowell run up the middle for 4 yards. That was the only one. Every other one was a pass. So you have your backup quarterback in, a guy who does not throw as well as your starting quarterback is. And as you point out, you're only down 7 at that point in time. And you decide to throw. I just don't understand that thinking.
Right. But then it was those 6 plays. I mean, that's what we're talking about, because then it was 14 and then there were 4 minutes left in the game. So we had 6 plays that Hugh Jackson probably should have run the ball on first down, but I'm sure his goal was not to put Cody Kessler in second and long, because we know how that turns out.
Yeah. But
your point's taken, because they ran the ball for 201 yards and only 4 of them, I believe, came in the fourth quarter.
How did they run the ball for 201 yards, by the way? That first 3 quarters that they did do so well, I mean, we haven't seen that all year. Isaiah Crowell had easily his best game. Kizer, of course, put his athleticism to work and got some yards as well. And Duke Johnson got 10 carries, which he needs more of. What was the difference? Is it the opponent? Is it the front 7 of Detroit that just wasn't very good?
Well, no, because Detroit, I mean, they're missing Zagianza, but they right. got a 6th-ranked run defense going into yesterday. So I don't think it was that. I think when I talk about Hugh game planning, I think he spread Detroit out a little bit. He used, and I don't have the stats in front of me, but it felt like he used a 3-receiver package more and spread Detroit out a little bit, and that opens up some room for Crowell and Duke Johnson. And then you get 57 yards from your quarterback, which is an added bonus, and that's one of the values of DeShone Kizer, is that he can get out and either run on a design run, and they did that a few times,
yep.
or make something out of nothing. So I think it was a combination, and if you have some success early throwing the ball, which they did, 38 yards on the first play, hit Kenny Britt on a couple of hooks, you make the defense aware, at least has to pay attention to the pass, and that's been a change, because early in the year they were just stacking against the run and saying, beat us, you can't. Well, if you start to beat them, then they have to adjust a little bit.
We're talking to Scott Petrak, who was on the Browns beat covering the 0-9 Browns, yesterday's loss up at Ford Field to the Lions, just continuing to add to misery and add to the Browns' failure and sometimes historic. Scott, let's talk about the end of the first half. The moment I saw DeShone Kizer sneak from 3 yards, not 3 inches, where you just need a little surge, 3 yards with 15 seconds left, and no timeouts, I literally started tweeting, he should be fired at halftime, talking about Hugh Jackson. How do you call that play in that circumstance? A quarterback sneak guarantees a massive pileup of bodies in the middle that Detroit is going to certainly take their time getting off of, which they did. They maybe could have been called for delay of game. But even if they did delay the game, I said you deserve every inch of this failure by that terrible call. Now, it has since been learned Hugh Jackson would not address how that play was called during the post game. He said repeatedly, it's on me, it's on me, it's on me, but he didn't say I made the call, and now we know why. And you confirmed it on BrownZone.com that DeShone Kizer audibled to that quarterback sneak. What did Kizer say and some of his teammates? I know you said you confirmed it on your piece through Joel Bitonio and Seth DeValve, they confirmed that it was audible, that it was DeShone's decision. What exactly did Kizer say? How did he explain that call?
Well, here's, when you talk about the things that Browns do incorrectly, you can argue that this is another one. So Hugh Jackson took responsibility for everything and then told DeShone Kizer to just go with what you said. So DeShone Kizer did not get into why he did what he did, if he even did what he did. And then that was yesterday. Today, Hugh said, I still don't want to talk about it. It's still my fault for everything. Kizer said he'll learn from it. He needs to be better down there, blah, blah, blah. But from talking to other people, it was a pass play, right? They call the pass. You can see if you watch a replay, Seth DeValve's running across the end zone. He thinks it's a pass play. But DeShone Kizer audibled into the sneak because he thought he could score. And I believe Hugh Jackson gives him that freedom where he says, okay, if it's wide open, you think you can sneak it here, go ahead. Now, Kizer made the mistake of, first of all, it wasn't wide open. Second of all, it was too far away for a normal sneak. And third of all, you're right about the pile. And they're never going to be able to get up and get the spike in time to kill the clock and kick a field goal with only 15 seconds. Or if you are, it's going to be because everything went 100% right. So Kaiser's at the line. He thinks he can score, so he's not worried about the clock running out. Thinks he can score, whispers to his offensive lineman, we're sneaking. They go for it, he gets stuffed, and then we know what happened. So I think it's a rookie quarterback kind of biting off more than he can handle in that you know, having too, maybe not too big an ego, but just thinking it's going to work. And thinking, yes, I've had success sneaking the ball. I'm going to try it again here. Now, the argument you can make is, should Coach Hugh Jackson even give him that latitude in such a situation?
Bingo. Bingo. That's exactly where I, because while my initial tweet and feeling when I saw that happen, and that was about the only part of the game I watched. Well, that in the first drive of the second half. That was the part that I allowed myself to watch. I originally tweeted he should be fired for calling that, and then I thought to myself, unless it was a Kaiser audible. And then I thought to myself again, like people care what goes on inside my brain. But my thought process at the time, Scott, was, well, if Kaiser called that, he did so with Hugh Jackson's permission. He's got permission as a first-year, second-round draft pick quarterback to decide what play he runs on the goal line. And I don't, how do you give that guy that authority at that particular point in time, given, and it's no diss on Deshaun, but sure, it is what it is. He has no experience making those decisions. He has no experience considering at that point in time, not only the down and distance, he needed 3 yards, as you say, too far, not the fact that there's going to be a big pile there, and not the fact that he has no timeouts and he's not going to be able to spike it. I just, that smacks of a coach. I don't want to use the words out of touch, but it just doesn't get it. I mean, that should be something that's drilled every day. Deshaun, you don't get to change the play, particularly on the goal line. You run what we call. How does he give him that authority at that point in time, given the circumstances?
I think that's a fair question. I would say it's more Hugh having too much trust in Deshaun. You know, and Hugh's the, you know, he has a quarterback's coach, but he spent so much time with Kaiser in the quarterbacks, and it's his offense, and they're supposed to be in lockstep. And I think Hugh.
You say you have so much trust in Deshaun, Scott, and you're right, but this is a guy that he has benched twice in the last 5 weeks. So, I mean, how much trust should he bestow on the guy?
Well, maybe he believes that in order to have the success or long term relationship he's looking for, that that's going to be necessary. And he's trying to build it. Now, I think, you know, in hindsight, it's okay that Deshaun audibles the rest of the game, because you need to get out of bad plays, you need to get in a good place. But it wouldn't be the worst thing, it's probably the best thing, to say, okay, in specific situations, that's not an option, right? I'm calling the play, I have more experience, so in these specific situations, just run what I tell, okay? And obviously that wasn't the case there. You know, and Hugh's thinking to himself, I'm sure when he says, okay, if it's wide open, you sneak it, that Deshaun Kaiser uses better judgment, right? I mean, let's say the Lions lined up in a different formation and he could easily sneak in and he scores, you know, then it's fine. Nobody cares, and it's kind of a bold call. It's a bold play by Deshaun Kaiser. But when it blows up, everybody is susceptible to blame, and, you know, I think you can put blame on both guys, Hugh Jackson and Deshaun Kaiser.
I'm okay with that, and I think you're right, and I would be more likely to excuse Deshaun because he isn't necessarily going to know better in that particular point in time because he doesn't have the experience. Hugh Jackson should. With all of his years as a coordinator and calling plays, he absolutely should have, and he also should have had more timeouts in his back pocket. Do you know, Scott, and maybe you answered it and I missed it, what the original play call was that Deshaun audibled out of and said, I can sneak it?
I believe it was a play-action pass. And they were hoping to get Seth DeValve, the tight end, coming across. If you watch it, if you watch the replay, the running backs are acting like it's a run play. Mm-hmm. But I know that it was a pass play, which leads me to think play action. You can see DeValve kind of get caught up in the line, like he's blocking, and then release. So I think it was, hopefully Seth DeValve comes wide open on one of those handoffs from inside the five, or you fake the handoff, and pop up, and the tight end's wide open. So I believe that's what the play call was.
Okay, well, that's important to know because, I mean, that's obviously what had to happen there is they needed to throw the ball. I personally would have liked to see them throw it more toward the boundary, you know, or into the back corner somewhere. But you have clearly, with 15 seconds left, enough time because the drop is going to be quick and the decision is going to be quick to throw two balls. At second and third down, you absolutely can get two pass plays in. The incompletion will stop the clock. And then, of course, you can kick your field goal if all else fails. You have time for that also. But the quarterback sneak, I just wanted to clarify that there wasn't a running play called on that because that's what I fear as I look at that and look at the back's action as you talk about. I just wondered, was he running into the line even if Kaiser had not audibled out of it, which would have still created the same pileup and the same, you know, end result.
Right. Well, I had the same question, Bob, and I just asked somebody 15 minutes ago in the locker room, who I can't tell you who it was, but who was in on the play and said it was a pass play that was called.
Okay. Well, that's good. I appreciate that. Scott, as we look forward just briefly here, Jacksonville comes in to Brown Stadium on Sunday, having won three in a row. First time they've done that in a few years. Then Cincinnati, who is flat out awful and still are out of control. You saw what happened with Perfect. The Chargers continue to find ways to lose games. The Packers have Brett Hundley, not Aaron Rodgers. Then Baltimore, Chicago with Mitch Trubisky, and Pittsburgh. So we're in the second half. There's seven left. Is there a win among that group?
Yeah, I think there is, Bob. I would bet that they win a game. Part of that is because it's really hard to go winless. I mean, we know that Detroit did the 1 year, but yeah. The Browns were awful last year and found a way to win. To me, when you looked at the last eight games, I thought Detroit might have been the least winnable game on the schedule. And the Browns played pretty well, and you could make an argument, could have won, at least should have been in it at the end. So I think that they're going to have opportunities to win games coming down the stretch. Now, this is assuming Kaiser continues to improve and play well. But, you know, Jacksonville doesn't blow me away. None of these teams blow me away. I think there's issues with every team they're going to face, except maybe the Steelers at the end, and they could be resting guys. So I expect the Browns to win one, maybe two, and that's what I'm sticking with.
Would this week be one of them?
I think there's a chance. I mean, Jacksonville's got a really good defense, and it's going to be a test. The Browns are missing Joe Thomas. They might be missing Sean Coleman, their right tackle, and the Jacksonville, I think, has two games with 10 sacks. So there's going to be challenges, but Blake Bortles, to me, is still Blake Bortles. And, you know, Jacksonville, this is my theory on most NFL teams. Jacksonville's not a team that should or usually wins four games in a row, which means they're set up for a hiccup. Now, it would have to be a big hiccup to lose to the Browns, but it wouldn't shock me at all.
Are the Jaguars the surprise team of the league in your mind? Because
in the Rams
preseason, they were going back and forth between Bortles and Henny, and they both looked terrible, and oh my God, they're going into this season with no quarterback, and even if they do have a decent defense, I mean, they were expected to be awful, and they sit here at 6-3, third best record in the AFC. That's saying something. Second best, I think. Best record is 7-2, I believe, right? Unless I lost my standings here.
New England.
Yeah. New England and Pittsburgh are both 7-2.
Yeah,
so 6-3 is the second best record in the AFC. There are a couple of teams that have it, themselves and the Titans, specifically in the same division. But the point is, that are they the surprise team in the league, or at the very least in the AFC?
Hey, I think it's fair to say that for sure. I mean, I had no expectations for Jacksonville. You know, they're the kind of team that for the last couple of years you thought might be a surprise team, and then Blake Bortles never got any better. And then you thought they kind of missed their window and that they were going to have to go find a new quarterback and kind of blow things up. I know, you know, they got a new coach, Doug Marrone, and Tom Coughlin is taking over there. And it just shows you how much an impact a front office guy can have, just the tone that Tom Coughlin sets in an organization. You know, he's been a winner everywhere. But, yeah, they're a surprise team, you know, and I'm not sure exactly how they're doing it with Blake Bortles. You know, obviously the run game helps, having a big-time defense helps. But he's made some plays, and he can get outside the pocket and do some things. So they're a surprise team, and then the Rams are obviously surprised. I know I didn't expect them to be at the top of the NFC West.
Scott Petrak breaking it down for us. The Browns 0-9 in pursuit of some sort of new history every single week, history of futility. Follow Scott's work on BrownsZone.com. BrownsZone.com. Like I said, it stops me from having to watch very much of the games. So, Scott, thanks very much. We'll talk again soon, my man.
Thanks, Buck.
Thank you, Scott. Scott Petrak joining us. And if you do not like going to those types of games, or if there are games you want to go to, but you just can't get tickets, you know the best place to watch your football games, Buffalo Wild Wings. And now you can earn loyalty points while watching games at B-Dubs with Blazin' Rewards. And if you hurry, you can earn those points by eating limited-time items like the Cali Chicken Sandwich, Fiesta Pork Tacos, the Specialty 35th Weck Sandwich, and so much more. Plus, like a quarterback has a favorite receiver, the Blue Moon Belgian White Beer has a favorite wing sauce to go along with it. Get the Blue Moon barbecue on your wings with that Belgian White. You are going to love it. Available for a limited time while supplies last, and only at Buffalo Wild Wings. Wings, beer, sports. Please drink responsibly. All right, we're going to get a quick timeout here. We'll get our bottom of the hour local sports center from Cush. On the other side of that, let's get the phones going again. Good calls in the end of the first hour. Let's do it again at 866-240-1065. What happens with the Final Four? Buckeye fans, do you see a path forward to a spot in the college football playoff again? or are those two ugly losses too ugly to overlook for the committee? We'll get into that in a little bit more coming up right here on the team.
Now, back to Bob France, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Yes, back indeed on a Monday afternoon quarterback edition of the Extravaganza. Pretty much locked into all things football this afternoon, and with very good reason. A lot of great stuff happened on Saturday, a lot of crazy stuff and shocking stuff as well on Elimination Saturday. Some teams, I think, have been eliminated from the college football playoff. And then, of course, we spent a lot of time talking about the Irish. I'm talking about Notre Dame. Yeah, I'll get back to that. The Lions and the Browns from Sunday. Kush, going back, we're talking with some good callers about this before. I think it is safe to say, tell me if you agree or disagree, Notre Dame is flat out done. They cannot make it with their two losses, even if they win out.
I think they're done, yes.
Okay, they're done. Stanford, by the way, ruined, shot a big hole in the Pac-12's chances of getting a spot in the playoff because Washington, top seed top-ranked team in the Pac, Washington, was beaten by Stanford, so they're pretty much done. They've got two losses. Washington State has two losses, and USC has two losses. None of them are ranked high enough to have a shot at this as well, so we can rule out the Pac-12. Agreed?
Yep, agreed.
Okay. So if the Pac-12 champ is out, and if Notre Dame as an independent are out, we stick with the other four remaining power conferences. Now, as I look at the, this is hard to do because I'm kind of trying to look at three different polls at once. I'm looking at the college football AP top 25 that is out now, the coaches poll that is out now, and I have to look at last week's for the time being, college football playoff rankings, which of course will be updated tomorrow night. But this is what we can say. Georgia, by virtue of its blowout loss at the hands of Auburn, it wasn't just a close loss, it was a blowout loss.
Right.
It would be very, very difficult for them to overcome that, other than if they beat the same team that just blew them out, potentially in an SEC championship game. If Auburn were to take down Alabama, meet Georgia in the SEC championship game, and Georgia rebounds from that and wins the SEC championship game, then the SEC champion has a shot, yes?
Yes.
So they'd be,
I do.
So they'd be 9-1. Their one loss could have been overcome by by a win, talking about Georgia. I'm talking about a win over the same Auburn team that beat them. Now, what if it's Alabama? Would it carry the same weight? What if undefeated Alabama beats Auburn in the Iron Bowl, faces Georgia in the SEC championship game, and Georgia wins that? Now we have one loss Bama. We have one loss Georgia. Does Georgia then get that spot by virtue of winning the SEC championship game? And does Alabama get one of the final four spots for being one loss Alabama, which is going to be better than probably one loss
anybody else. So
arguably.
Right. And so tagging it at the very end like that, my answer is I lean yes towards that.
Towards both of them getting in.
Yes, in that scenario.
All right. So help me out then again. And I'm trying to look at this from a three different poll standpoint. So bear with me. I'm probably going to trip over this a little bit as we try to make some sense out of this. Clemson right now is ranked fourth in the AP. They will face Miami in the ACC championship game, who is ranked number two. Winner is in, loser is out. But what if the loser is Miami? What if undefeated Miami loses to Clemson and is also like the same SEC scenario I just drew up? What if Miami ends up 11-1? They're a one-loss Miami team, and then there would be a one-loss Alabama team. There's a one-loss Clemson team, which would have just punched its ticket by winning the SEC or the ACC championship. In the scenario I just drew up, you'd have one loss Georgia, who would have punched their ticket by way of winning the SEC championship. So you have two conference champions there and two one-loss runner-ups in Miami and Georgia. Take those two teams and throw into the mix one-loss Oklahoma, assuming they win the Big 12 championship, and then you would have potentially undefeated Wisconsin or two-loss Ohio State if they were to take Wisconsin down in the Big Ten championship game. How do you find four out of those eight?
Well, and that's very, very tricky. And obviously,
and I think that's
we're
it,
we're
right? I mean, under those circumstances, those would be the eight.
Yeah, those would essentially be the eight. And if I have to reduce that to four based on the scenarios you lined up, it would, to me, it would be Georgia, Alabama, Oklahoma, and that ACC winner. Those would be your four. Wisconsin.
Why do you go
probably
with the
outside?
Hold on. Why do you go automatically with the Georgia-Alabama combo instead of the Clemson-Miami combo? If it's Clemson
because
that beats
I think
Miami
in
Miami, that's their first loss.
Because I think if the committee is looking at both scenarios being nearly identical, they're going to give it to the SEC over the ACC.
So you think that's what the committee would do?
Yes.
You're not necessarily saying that's the right thing to do.
Correct.
Now let me ask you that last question. Is that the right thing to do?
That's the tough one, because then you're really debating, is the top of the ACC better than the top of the SEC? Because if you have Georgia, Bama, Miami, Clemson, all with one loss, which would mean Georgia and Miami.
And Oklahoma
getting,
with one loss.
And Oklahoma with one, yeah, let's not forget them. And Wisconsin, who could be undefeated. I think they would that's really tough. I mean, it really boils down to what do you think is the better top of the conference, Miami and ACC with Clemson or Georgia and Alabama in the SEC? And that's a trickier question, I think, than more people realize right now.
It surely is. And you know what? I'll tell you what. The committee has to be just thanking their lucky stars that Notre Dame lost.
I think
and,
so. I deep
and
down,
lost
I think
decisively
so.
Because then they don't even have that last weekend, that conference championship
Bingo.
Weekend,
the 13th
to make the case
data point,
Oregon.
They call it.
Say again?
The 13th data point, as they call
it. Yeah, exactly. They're just sitting at home saying, hey, we stand on our record. You know, one loss Notre Dame, and, you know, you figure out what you do with all those one loss conference teams. But we have to be one of them.
Yep.
And there very well might have been a case for that had they beaten Miami.
Absolutely,
but they got thrown out, so they're out. And then I just have to throw Ohio State in there. If Ohio State wins out, and that includes an impressive win over Michigan, the Illinois win is just going to be crap. But let's call it an impressive win over Michigan, and let's call it a solid win over Wisconsin.
Who we're predicting will be undefeated at the time.
Yes, in the Big Ten championship game. And so now you got a two-loss team. Is there any way that two-loss team would slide in over the second SEC team, which would not be a conference champion? Ohio State has two losses, yes. But Georgia, let's just say in that scenario that we laid out there, Alabama mm-hmm. wins and Georgia loses.
Right.
No, I'm sorry.
You mean Georgia wins, beats
Georgia
Alabama.
Georgia wins and Alabama loses.
Right.
Which gives each of them one loss. So Georgia is in because they're the SEC champion.
And then Clemson beats Miami to make each of them one loss to add further confusion. I still in that scenario do not think.
And then two-loss Ohio State comes rolling along. But they're two losses. They can't go in over those two teams we just talked about, but they are the Big Ten champ.
Right. And that's a scenario. There's too many one-loss teams that even with a Big Ten title, they're not going to give it to a two-loss Ohio State in that scenario. They won't.
That's what the committee is going to have to try to sort out. We'll see if we have any indication.
Go to eight. This is shaping up to be
right?
a perfect year for eight.
There, yes, it is. Yes, it absolutely is. So we'll see what the committee has to say tomorrow night. And, of course, we'll spend some more time speculating on it. It's what they want us to do. And like the suckers we are all in on doing just that. Stay where you are. Drive Time is coming up next. We'll see you tomorrow right here on The Ticket.